Our next case is Love and Care Limited versus Lorraine, docket number 22-1905. And you're Ms. Counselor Weiser, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Counselor Fisher.
Yes.
Let me make sure I have the arguments correct. You're going to, on the main case, you're going to address 4 minutes. You're reserving 3 for rebuttal. And Ms. Fisher has 13 minutes and 2 minutes she's reserved to rebut on the counterclaim. So you'll go for 12 minutes. She goes for 13. You go for 3, and she goes for 2.
I understand that during my time I can address my rebuttal to what Ms. Reisman said and my cross appeal, and that my rebuttal is limited to anything she said on her rebuttal.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
And Your Honor, just so I'm sure that I understand as well, I may, in my original 12 minutes, get into some of the issues that she has raised.
In my rebuttal, you can only rebut what Counselor Fisher addresses in her 13 minutes. Okay?
Thank you.
Want to split away? You may start.
May it please the Court, Carol Reisman on behalf of Loving Care Limited and Mr. A. Pagan. As you might imagine, over the past few weeks, I've read and reread a lot of patent cases. This case stands out. This case, we started out with deposition of Ms. Lorraine, at which she couldn't recall having searched for dog bone mats. Many years later, after much discovery, we filed a motion for summary judgment. We wanted to file a motion for summary judgment early on in the case, but Easy Peasy had vehemently opposed that. They had insisted that there be a scheduling order with a Markman hearing, full factual discovery, expert reports, and expert depositions before a motion for summary judgment could be filed. When we filed our motion for summary judgment, after holding up the shield of privilege for years, they then decided that they needed to use a good faith excuse, and so they...
The facts are very, you know, there's a lot of them, but we're familiar with them. You started out by saying the case stands out. Perhaps you were trying to reference your 285 motion. The district court said the case doesn't stand out for exceptional case standards under Section 285. Isn't that entirely within the district court's discretion?
Well, Your Honor, as Judge Reyna said and Judge Hughes agreed in the Adjusticam decision, deference is not absolute. If there is a clear error in the district court's decision, this court can and has reversed.
The district court found that there were difficult legal questions here. Do we get to say that they were not close?
Well, Your Honor, I think the issue is that the district court didn't consider the two factors that Octane Fitness requires. The district court said that there were close legal issues, but the legal issues weren't close. The district court, even if the inequitable conduct decision is not reversed, even if the inequitable conduct decision stands, the district court found without question there was gross negligence on the part of Ms. Lorraine and Mr. Williams. So without question, there was a breach of the duty to the patent office with respect to disclosures made to them.
But that seems to me different than whether it was hard to decide that as a fact finder, whether the questions presented were legally challenging. Can we say that the district court was clearly wrong about those things?
Your Honor, I think that we can say that the district court was clearly wrong in that the factual findings that it made with respect to the misconduct in litigation, a finding of unclean hands is horrible misconduct during litigation. The district court used very strong words, reprehensible conduct, that it had lost all faith in Ms. Lorraine's ability to tell the truth, that there was deceit established with all the times that Mr. Bolton and Ms. Lorraine couldn't recall. The problem is, Your Honor, that the court reached a conclusory statement that the costs were run out by both sides, which clearly ignores its own findings and the record in this case. There was nothing that was done unreasonably by Loving Care. In fact, the court found that with respect to Loving Care's LUPTA claim, it said that it was reasonable. The court dismissed the Lanham Act claim by saying it was a dismissal without prejudice because there was no current evidence of the boycott and social media attacks.
On inequitable conduct, where the district court was a fact finder as well, right? And the district court found that you failed to prove deceptive intent. You're right, however, there can be no dispute that, for instance, with Platinum Pets, that the failure to disclose it was not accidental, it was deliberate. But again, wasn't that a heavily contested fact dispute at an 8-day bench trial, and the district court made its findings?
Well, Your Honor, the district court did make certain findings with respect to deceptive intent. And one thing I want to point out that the district court didn't address in its findings, which is the advice that Mrs. Lorraine got to disclose the Platinum Pets advertisement that she had found. She got that advice from Mr. McCarthy. She never disclosed that Platinum Pets advertisement to Mr. Williams, and she never presented an excuse for doing so. She never presented an excuse for not doing it, and that very advertisement shows the functionality that she claims, peeling at the outer edge. Instead, what she did was she gave Mr. Williams an Amazon ad that didn't show that functionality. He then used that, and the problem, Your Honor, here is that when there is direct evidence of deceptive intent, as there was here, this is one of those rare cases. The drawing of inferences by the district court was in error. The inferences were illogical. They were inconsistent with the direct evidence, and the witness's own testimony was inconsistent, entirely inconsistent. And the United States Supreme Court in Gypsum has said that even on credibility findings, that if there's inconsistent internal testimony or there's documentary evidence that contradicts it, that is clear error, and that would be a form for reversal. The district court also made clear legal errors. The district court looked to the intent of the declarants as opposed to Ms. Lorraine's intent. And so in finding that, the district court clearly erred. That means there was an abuse of discretion. The district court also failed to look at the collective weight of the evidence. Instead, each act or inaction was looked at on an isolated basis. In our bench verdict form, we asked the court, question 12, to please look at the collective weight of the evidence and say whether or not there was deceptive intent. And there's precedent in this court that you can't look at each act in isolation. You must look at the collective weight, and the district court erred in not doing that. The district court also committed legal error in finding that the self-sealing art that it found as a factual finding based on demonstrations that self-sealed, that it was cumulative of Platinum Pets, but they had misrepresented Platinum Pets to the patent office as not self-sealed, even though they had video and had, as the district court found, had observed the suction sound, which the suction sound could only come about if there was a breaking of a partial vacuum. The district court also found, and one important thing, Your Honor, is that you have to look at the findings that were made on the obviousness decision at the same time or released at the same time as the stated factual findings. Ms. Lorraine, based on direct evidence, honestly admitted that she didn't think she was going to find a material scientist who would give her the answer that she wanted, that is, that her invention was unexpected. So that finding is contained within the obviousness decision, but it was seemingly overlooked in reaching the conclusion on inequitable conduct.
part of what's confusing here for me is the procedure, because I know the case was pending for a while, and maybe COVID had something to do with it, but by the time you got to the bench trial, the district court had already decided that the patents were invalid as obvious, and I think denied a motion for reconsideration of that, but then addresses obviousness again after the bench trial? Is
well,
that right?
What happened was originally at that point, Your Honor, we were moving forward with the jury trial on the design patent and the trade dress infringement claims. And at that point, the Lucta claims and the Lanham Act claims were still pending. Easy Peasy at that point filed the motion, the reexamination with the patent office. And so Easy Peasy had previously argued, oh, all of this evidence about inequitable conduct and duties to the patent office, those are moved now because the court has ruled on obviousness. But once Easy Peasy then, after two bites at the apple, in trying to defend the motion for summary judgment and then reconsideration, then they filed their reexamination. And then at that point is when the district court said, well, that he was going to hear the evidence, inequitable conduct and unclean hands first. And then down the road, he put off the jury trial on the design patent because he wanted to determine whether or not there was inequitable conduct and unclean hands first.
And is it your contention that all the evidence that came out of trial is fairly considered in connection with the obviousness cross appeal and vice versa, that all the obviousness evidence is fair to consider on inequitable conduct on your appeal?
Your Honor, I believe it is. I think that the case law supports that. And I think, you know, an important thing is that at the bench trial, the district court was able to look at the physical exhibits and see for itself, you know, what happened.
Right, but where it gets confusing, at least for me, is the district court is sitting as a fact finder on the equitable issues, but not on the validity issue, which I know is the cross appeal. It just seems like I'm not sure that it's as simple as the whole record can be treated the same for all of the issues. But that is your contention.
Well, yes, Your Honor. And in the original motion for summary judgment, one of the main arguments by Easy Peasy, because at that point we had a demonstration of Ms. Lorraine lifting a pink tongue tipping mat, having not put anything on it to set the partial vacuum, if you will, but instead tried to lift it. At that point, Easy Peasy argued, well, the pink, without any support, without any evidentiary support, just argument, well, the pink tongue tipping mat is a new version. It wasn't available when Ms. Lorraine filed her application in 2014. And the evidence presented at the trial was undisputed. It came from the physical exhibit itself, the very same pink Tommy Tippy mat with the markings on the back showing that it had actually been manufactured in either 2010 or 2011. The expert couldn't tell because the dates were put back and forth. But that piece of evidence is very important to the obviousness because there was no plate or cup put on the pink Tommy Tippy mat. It was lifted up. I see I'm approaching my time for my rebuttal, so if you have any other questions, if not, I'll reserve my time.
All right, thank you. We'll reserve your time. Councilor Fisher.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I'll pick up on the points that Ms. Reisman started with. The district court has the power to decide the exceptional cases firmly within the trial court discretion, and here it decided that it was not an exceptional case, and that ruling should be affirmed. As main points, the trial court, after an 8-day trial with both direct and cross-examination of the witness and observing those witnesses in person, found that LNC did not prove that there was an equitable conduct by Easy Peasy.
At the same time, and I know you'll get to your cross-appeal, the district court found you acted with unclean hands and was pretty scathing about your clients and about counsel. I'm a little bit nervous about the message it sends if we say this case does not involve inequitable conduct and this case is not exceptional and does not stand out. What kind of message does that send?
Well, two things. One, our cross appeal is that unclean hands needs to be reversed.
Say it again.
One, our cross appeal is that unclean hands needs to be reversed, that it fails to meet both requisite elements. One, that the five discrete acts identified by the court are not unconscionable acts. They don't rise to that level as a matter of law. And second, that there is no necessary or immediate relation identified by the court as to those acts and the claims that were dismissed. There is certainly language at the end of the opinion about reprehensible conduct and loss of candor. However, the case law is clear that unclean hands is not meant to be used to punish. It's compensatory, and it's supposed to be directed to acts that have an effect on the equitable relations between the parties. Here, that finding's not made, and arguably there are facts in the record that show that finding cannot even be made. So I don't think that the exceptional case can rely on just that.
So if you were to find, just assuming you find against it, then the matter went back, would we have to vacate and remand for further fact finding, or could we straight out reverse?
On the inequitable finding? I believe it would be dependent on how the court structured their issue. I think that my colleagues have asked for a straight reversal.
Okay.
The finding by the court of no inequitable conduct, which was also, you know, part and parcel of the finding that this was not an exceptional case, was based on competent and adequate evidence that there is no intent to deceive with respect to how Platinum Pets was disclosed. I think that was the main focus of my colleagues' briefing, are with respect to the declarations.
How about with respect to the withholding of the video and everything with Platinum Pets?
Well, there are two things on that. One, that there's actually unrebutted testimony in the record that the suction sound actually shows the opposite of self-sealing. So the lack of suction sound is actually closer to self-sealing. So the video that was disclosed was one that showed a product closer to self-sealing. If you look at the email itself, the quote undisclosed video, the characterization by Mr. Williams is it looks like it attempts to self-seal but fails. It is not a video where they even believe that it shows some type of self-sealing.
Aside from what the content of the videos talk, what about the decision as to what to reveal to the PTO or not?
Well, I think that if the videos were reviewed, one, the suction sound is negligible between the two. But two, there's...
I'm at the district court level.
Oh, sorry. Could you repeat the question? To the district court? At the district court, both the disclosed and undisclosed videos were disclosed to LNC and Discovery. The finding was that the undisclosed video should have been disclosed to the PTO, but both videos were at the district court level in trial and were provided to LNC. So there wasn't a withholding at the trial court level of those videos in any manner.
If I could turn you back to the exceptional case issue, what did the district court say that LNC did to make the litigation more expensive or made their conduct exceptional?
Well, it wasn't that they said their conduct was exceptional. They said it was aggressively litigated, and it identified that LNC had taken approximately, I think it's 20 depositions by having.
Right, it seemed like it was all very ordinary things in a typical hard-fought patent case between competitors. Did the district court ever make any finding that there was something vexatious or improper or unreasonable in any way?
No, the court just said it was aggressively litigated on both sides.
And is that sufficient to support the district court's finding that both sides were equally responsible for how this case was litigated?
I think it is. The court said essentially in the totality of the circumstances that both sides aggressively litigated the case and that there were closed issues. I think that
there's nothing like the finding that the district court lost confidence in counsel or witnesses for LNC, is there?
No, there's not.
How about the prevailing party issue? I was unclear what your position is on appeal. Doesn't the district court have to determine who's the prevailing party?
With respect to costs?
On the 285, yeah, exactly.
I think that there are a lot of issues decided at the trial court. LMC won some and lost some.
Right, but doesn't our case law say that when there's an exceptional case motion under 285, there is one and only one prevailing party, and district court has to figure out who that is?
But the exceptional case isn't completely reliant on the prevailing party. A prevailing party isn't entitled to fees under exceptional case. So
not entitled, but entitled to move for it.
Yes. And I don't believe we argue that they were not entitled to move for fees under exceptional
No, but that, the argument from your friend is that one of the legal errors the district court made here is it just entirely did not decide the legal threshold question of who is the prevailing party. What is your position on that? Was that a legal error or was it not?
I do believe that the court does need to decide a prevailing party.
And who is the prevailing party here?
The LNC prevailed with respect to some issues, but EZPZ prevailed with respect to some issues as well. And I don't think that the exceptional case analysis is dependent on the prevailing party. I think that comes in with respect to costs. And with respect to costs, the court decided LLC was the prevailing party, but still did not award costs. There was, where I left off is I believe that there was sufficient evidence in the record that there was no intent with respect to the how platinum pest was disclosed or the declarations, which was the focus of my colleague's brief. With respect
how does this court's decision in Theracense help or hurt your case?
I'm sorry?
How does our decision in Theracense help or hurt your case?
I believe that it helps our case. I think that you need to, in order to reach inequitable conduct, the bar was raised. It was meant to consolidate and try to eliminate the plague of inequitable conduct cases that were coming before the court. That there are two very specific findings that need to be made by the court before inequitable conduct can be found, both materiality and intent to deceive. And if either of those are not found, inequitable conduct cannot be found. And that there's no finding that sort of sliding scale of materiality can impact intent to deceive. So I think those two very specific findings that need to be made help our case here, that the court went through each and found that there wasn't sufficient evidence to support the finding of intent to deceive. The LNC also raises this misstep of a material scientist, but this is another important point because this has come up several times, is that EZPZ was not claiming that silicone, that the functionality it was claiming, this self-contact self-sealing, was an inherent property of silicone. So the properties of silicone that a material scientist would have testified to were not relevant. EZPZ here was claiming that the structure of the planar portion was what created the contact surface self-sealing. And to the procedure, I'd like to address that. There were both legal errors and procedural errors here. There was a motion for summary judgment seeking to invalidate the patent for obviousness, which was denied. We then, EZPZ then filed a motion for reconsideration in the District Court of Louisiana. They issued both an order and a ruling at the time orders come down. So we filed the motion for reconsideration. It was ripe. And then we got an order that denied the motion for reconsideration that said there would be a ruling in due course. And then we didn't get that ruling until 14 months later after trial. And then we filed the motion for reconsideration. We got the order denying it, but the ruling that purported to support that order didn't come down for 14 months and then used trial testimony to support the order that had entered 14 months prior. And sort of a general fact that there was multiple factual findings in there, which is obviously improper from on summary judgment.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
We disagree with the district court on inequitable conduct and find that the only reasonable inference is inequitable conduct. We don't need to reach these obviousness questions, right?
the inequitable conduct would vitiate the patent on those grounds. So, yes, correct.
In fact, that would be dispositive of the entire case, wouldn't it?
I think that's right. With respect to obviousness, the court's grant of summary judgment with its ancillary rulings on a motion for reconsideration and the Rule 59 motion requires remand. And I should say the Rule 59 motion was brought because the trial court would not permit at trial the fact that the 903 patent was confirmed and affirmed on reexamination. That information was not for ECPC was not permitted to provide that information to the trial court. And the Rule 59 sought to have that information before the trial court and to be analyzed by the trial court. In those orders, their impermissible factual findings by the court, it gives no consideration, it fails to give due consideration to secondary considerations, and it does not offer any reasoned analysis on the motion to combine. It just says it would be obvious to try. The secondary.
Unclean hands, which is the other part of your cross appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the district court did not clearly articulate the immediate and necessary link between the unconscionable acts and the claims you were bringing in equity, if we think there's evidence to support that conclusion, can we consider and affirm on the basis of that other evidence, or are we only reviewing what the district court articulated?
I believe you're constrained to what the district court articulated, its findings that those were unconscionable acts. And the immediate and necessary relation to the claims that are dismissed is a necessary link. If not, there would just be sort of punishing wrongdoing in the abstract, assuming that one believes there's wrongdoing. And punishing wrongdoing in the abstract is not permitted by the unclean hands doctrine. It's an equitable doctrine.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
First, I'd like to address Judge Stark's question. And with respect to the unclean hands, I disagree with my colleague. As the prevailing party, Loving Care is able to put forth any grounds to support the ruling, and I think we've already put that forward. I mean, clearly, the lack of credibility on the part of Ms. Lorraine with respect to the issues that she testified to at the bench trial carries over to the other issues.
How about on obviousness here? It seems to me the district court resolved a whole bunch of factual disputes about the scope of the prior art, about motivation to combine. Those were issues that should have been put in front of the jury, weren't they?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe so. The court had previously ruled in our favor on the motion for summary judgment based on the clear language of Webb. And the Webb patent.
Does the district court ever say no reasonable fact finder could possibly read Webb in a contrary manner?
I don't know if it uses those exact words, but no reasonable person of ordinary skill in the art could read Webb in a contrary manner. And I believe one.
Then how do you explain the patent office on re-exam looking at that very prior art and granting a re-exam certificate?
Because the patent office said that they believed that there had to be a downward force to set and cause the partial vacuum. That language clearly only relates to.
Do our cases require the district court to consider the re-exam certificate in deciding whether there's a genuine issue of material fact as to validity?
Your Honor, just as in any issuance of a patent, whether it be on an original issue or on a reissue, that does create a presumption of validity. That doesn't mean that as a matter of law.
But in evaluating whether the record reveals a genuine issue of material fact, the re-exam certificate has to be a consideration, does it not?
That does have to be a consideration, but when the undisputed facts which came out of the bench trial, for example, in the re-exam, they argued that it was unlikely that the pink Tommy Tippy map preceded the filing date, and the facts showed that not to be true. The facts also, undisputed documentary evidence, established and then confirmed the prior motion for summary judgment. There was also evidence both by Mr. Henley, who testified that a person of ordinary skill in the art would see these things, that the partial vacuum and the self-sealing of silicone were known to persons of ordinary skill in the art. So under KSR, it is obvious and expected as a matter of law. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Counsel, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. I think that the argument of counsel highlights the main fact with the main problem with the obviousness here. She said that the undisputed facts at trial, the trial testimony was used to resolve summary judgment, and that there were findings of fact by the trial court in doing so. It's black letter law that summary judgment can only be granted if there's no genuine issue of material fact. I would also say the re-exam specifically states that, and this is at appendix 15,975, the examiner concurs that the mat of the prior art does not self-seal. It was the web mat that the PTO had before it, and that only with pressure on the center portion will the vacuum form.
And the trial was not about obviousness.
The trial was not about obviousness, Your Honor. It also highlights another problem, is that the Pink Tommy tippy mat was admitted at the trial with respect to whether, let me rephrase that. The trial court said that we had a basis to argue against the Pink Tommy tippy mat at trial. We did not, because Easy Peasy did not have the Pink Tommy tippy mat. So there was no reason to argue against that with respect to inequitable conduct. And then the court used that art with respect to the obviousness determination. It was error that compels reversal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes our arguments for this morning. We're taking all the cases under advisement, and this court stands in recess.
The honorable court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.